Accession number 12709, Mr. Albert Reynolds, Albert Davis, reel 5.
Albert Davis, reel 5. Can you tell me what you can recall of the final retreat over the canals and onto the beachhead at Dunkirk, Mr. Davis?
Well, as I recall, on one of the canals, we were right in control because we were overlooking Jerry, and we thought, oh, well, this is our first chance that we can really bash him. And you could see Jerry tanks and infantry marching slowly towards us, and very cautiously. They only come a little way and then stop, a little way and stop. I thought, oh, with the Bren guns on the anti-tank gun, and that we've got a chance of giving him a right bashing. And, of course, the bridge, not far away, was guarded. Anyway, we sat there, until late evening. We had a message to say, right, we withdraw from there. And we couldn't understand why, because there was nothing happening as far as we couldn't understand why, so we withdrew. And I said, well, Jerry's broke through, made a bridgehead further south, and if we stayed there, he'd just have surrounded us. So therefore, they had to withdraw us back to counterattack the ones that had broken through.
Did you feel particularly angry that this happened so often?
Well, yes, because for once you thought you got the upper hand, you know, you got a better view. He was down below, and you got a good field of a view, and you could make everyone count. But that wasn't very often you got a view like that, because you were always usually on the opposite side. Jerry got a good view of you, and it made you angry, you know, but there's another thing you have to accept and go by what they say.
Was this having any effects upon the morale of the unit as a whole?
Yes, but only for a short time, I think. At the time, people were angry, you know, cursing and blarting and shouting, but it did no good. You may as well keep quiet. Just say, well, I've got to do what they say in the end. Or you get left behind and taken prisoner. Well, some, I think, deliberately you stayed behind and got took prisoner. That they'd had enough, you know, and shell-shocked. And
did you see any men who were suffering in this way?
I've seen lots of men with shell-shocked and very, very nervous, trembling, you know, all over. I can't say that I ever see one that's actually giving himself up. But there's no doubt about some of them did.
At what stage did you know that you were actually pulling back to the coast?
Well, almost from the start. I said that we would head for the coast. But then again, we didn't know which coast or where. They never said Dunkirk or whatever. We just had to follow wherever we were told to go, from place to place. I had no clue where we were going. In fact, most of the lads, I think, thought that, right, he was cutting round towards Calais. We know Calais was cut off. oh, they're going to take us to Dunkirk, put us on boats, sail down the channel, and land further down towards Normandy and restart again. That was our first thought, and that's what we thought we'd do. But that didn't come off, because I had already said that I had information that he'd surrounded one unit around Calais, and I believe that was the part of the HD, I'm not sure. Highland Division. I'm not sure. I mean, it's only what I've read in books.
What were your responses? How did you respond to appearing on the beach and the question of getting off there? Had you been told that you were going to get off in any way?
Well, I personally, when we got to the beach, I thought it was crazy. Destroying all vehicles and guns. Because we'd still got a few rounds of ammunition left. I said, well, it's crazy. Why destroy a gun when it's still got some ammunition left? Doesn't matter. Destroy it. Put, you know, block the barrel up, put a grenade in it, and take the firing mechanism out and scatter it, throw it away, or disfigure it in one way or another. I thought, well, they could wait till the last minute, then fire it, because you'd still have time to blow it up. But no, blow it up. That was crazy to me, because it doesn't matter whether it hit anybody or whether it didn't hit anybody. The more you could fire their way, the less chance of they got advancing on you. They got to be cautious then. It held them up, and that sort of thing.
What were the scenes on the beaches?
Well, you look around, all you could see was troops, horses, dead, cattle, dead. All sorts of things. Rifles sticking in the ground, tin hats, load of junk, vehicle on the vehicle occasionally, trying to get through, you know, the soft sand and pulled him to a halt. And try to get to the, because they tried to make a landing place with vehicles, but on La Pad sands it's more or less open, just the sand dunes, and all you could see was men. Most of them got greatcoats on, although it was hot in June. At night time it went very cold.
What were your thoughts when you saw this mass of men?
I don't know, really. I thought, well, I can't see us getting away on a ship. Too many men here. And it looks as if we either end up prisoners or get killed. Because there was a rumour I went round saying that our division was selected as a suicide division. How true that was, I don't know. At the time, and they thought, oh, Durham's again. You know, that was the first thing. Durham's again. There's no other bloody regiments to take part in this battle. But it was due to be a suicide regiment. You fought to the last man, and that was it. What was left, prisoner. Anyway, that was cancelled, apparently. And next thing I knew, 2 o'clock in the morning, 2nd of June, right, very quietly and efficiently, like, come through saying, right, each sergeant get his section together, quietly, orderly, and follow the crowd up. There's a boat waiting to pick us up. And that's what we did. It was a long pier sort of thing. Planks of wood missing, you just had to jump across, or jump in the sea. You know, but it was all done. very efficient, no panic, until we got on the boat.
What boat was it that you were taken off on?
Do you know, I can't tell you whether it was a destroyer, a minesweeper, or what it was. I couldn't see what type, because it was dark. And all as I remember, after I got on the boat, I scrambled over the side. One of the sailors come to me and said, "Look, would you like a drink of cocoa and a piece of bread and butter?" I said, "I'd love it," because we hadn't eaten for days then. And you know, that piece of bread and butter tasted delicious. I thought there was nothing ever tasted nicer to me than that piece of bread and butter. Anyway, I ate it, gluttoned it, I think. Now, I drank the cocoa. I just slumped down by the side of the deck. You know, just sank bodily, and I was asleep. And I never knew a thing. If the ship had gone down, I'd have gone down with it, sleeping. I never knew a thing until they woke me up at Dover. I was that exhausted. You know, we'd been marching for days and days and grabbing a bit of grub when we could. Even on the beach, there was no grub. The French, they were different. There was dead horses, and I was watching them carve like big slices of melons out of the backside of the rump of the horse. You know, cut it in the shape of a melon, pull it out and eat it. All the blood running down it. Oh, I was hungry, but not that hungry. The bread and butter tasted better than that to me.
Had the beaches been under attack whilst you were on them?
It was being shelled. Shelled, yes. But no, I can't recall any machine gun bullets. But it was being shelled, it was being dive-bombed and strapped. That was the biggest thing. See, there again you get no... And all I saw was one bolt from a Paul, that was the day before. It had got a turret on. It was like a hurricane, but with a turret on. And I believe that surprised Jerry, because he didn't think that, he thought it was hurricane, but he didn't know that they got a rear turret to it. I think it surprised him partly. But all the lads were saying, "Wait till I get back." There was terrific bad feeling about the Air Force, because we never saw any of our Air Force. And the officer explained, "Well, they're at more vital points, what's needed here." And, you know, all sorts of things said. And you've got to assume that they were right. When you stopped and thought about it, you think it could be right.
So you slept the journey?
Yeah, I didn't know a thing.
What was the reception when you got back to Dover? Was it Dover that you landed?
Dover, yeah. Yeah, he woke me up at Dover and said, "Come on, you're Dover." I said, "Don't be so daft." Because I didn't expect it. I expected to go down the channel and re-land at a different port in France. No, he says, "You're at Dover." And I could see it had got Dover written on it. Well, I felt very disheartened. You know, I suppose it's like a boxer that loses, you know. And he had to put a very good show. You felt very disheartened, you know, and it was no use trying to explain to the population, the people, about it, because they'd never understand it. And you couldn't. Anyway, we got some sandwich and tea on train, and next thing we knew, we were at Borden, Camp Borden, near Aldershot.
What happened there?
Well, we were greeted there, allotted tents, and had a clean up, a good meal, next morning, Sir Anthony Eden, he was Defence Minister then, he gave us a lecture saying that he is very sorry, you know, and that all this happened, but the next time that we go into action, he says, we would have some weapons to fight with. And he'd make sure that we had the right weapons to fight with, not inferior weapons. And of course that did improve, because from the desert onwards it was a little bit more combined. The Air Force came into it more, and the Navy was always pretty good with the Army anyway. And I can't blame the Air Force at all, really. When you look back, they did what they had to do. They hadn't got the planes and the pilots to fly them anyway. But the Air Force, when we joined, say, like D-Day, combined operations, that was perfect. Because one couldn't blame the other then, and each was doing its part. And what's more, the Army could see the Navy and the Air Force doing his job, and the Air Force could see that the Army and the Navy were doing their job. And everybody was happy, and that's when it really got together, as a fighting unit. And that's how it should be.
Were you given leave after Dunkirk?
Yes, yes.
And did you go home?
Yes, I went home, yeah.
What was the mood of the people, the civilians, at that time?
Well, they seemed reluctant to ask us about anything, you know, and I was reluctant to talk about it. I'd never talked about what went on. If I might have answered briefly, but in yourself you felt as if you'd let everybody down, and yet in your own heart you knew you hadn't, because odds were so great against you. And so there's only one thing: time would tell. Let it go by.
Was there any feelings of anger between yourselves coming back from Dunkirk and the action, and those men of the same age who hadn't yet gone into the Army for one reason or another, or the forces for one reason or another? You see many people of that age and that
No, I can't say that I met up with anybody that like that at all. The most anger was against, as I said before, that against the Air Force. Some of the lads wouldn't have it, that the Air Force are doing other jobs. They said they should have been there with the Army, you know, they adamant that they should have been there where the fighting was taking place to help the, or to keep us Stukas off. Well, we all know now.
After you leave, where did you go to?
After leave, we went to the southwest country, Abbotsbury, on the coast. And even then, on a beach which a big ship could land, it was so deep, all I had was one rifle and one 12-inch searchlight. Now, I said, if they expect me to put that searchlight on anything, well, and the two or three lads that were with me all agreed the same. If they expect us to shine that searchlight on anything that's coming, they've got another thing coming, because I'd never switch it on. Because the first thing, I know, if I was in the same situation, I always looked at it the other way, you see. First thing I'd do is put the light out. And the bloke that's operating it, his light would be put out as well. So that was senseless, really, having them. I mean, a flare is a much better proposition than a searchlight. Searchlight would look further, but a flare would, when you shoot it up in the sky, a flare would light all the floor up.
What time of the year did you arrive in Abbotsbury?
July. About July. It was nice and warm, I know that.
What was the state of the battalion at that time?
Well, still very dejected. Very dejected, but we were told to forget it and rebuild our morale up. And it took a long time to do it, like. But there was lots of reinforcement, new faces. And I think that helped to put things right. See, because they started asking questions. What was it like and what, you know. And they sort of agreed that we hadn't got much chance. Oh, well, they said, well, we're not going without us. We've got something, good equipment to go with.
Where were the reinforcements coming from?
Well, all different regiments. Different regiments, Scottish, down in Cornwall, Inniskillings, whoever had got surplus sent their surplus to other regiments to make up the strength of the battalions.
How did they settle in? Because they themselves were coming from their own area regiment into a
one. A lot of chaos like came. Well, they were like us in the first place. They were disgruntled. No, they didn't like it. But again, after they settled down with the Durhams, they did like it. No, they were quite happy. Very much the same as reaction as what we did in 1939. It was one seems to be attached to the initial regiment. But I made some very good friends in Durham's, and I've no regrets whatsoever. I mean, it's nice to fight for your county. But whoever you're fighting for the country, not the county, aren't you?
What was the equipment situation like in the initial stages?
Well, after Dunkirk, it was very bad. Because issuing us with a 12-inch searchlight for the beach denotes that. I mean, all we had was a 12-inch searchlight and one rifle. I can't remember that there was even a brain gun within 50 yards of where I was. There was brain guns, but scattered very wide. I'm few. But we never had any additional equipment for quite some months after.
Was the transport situation just as bad? Lorries, carriers and so forth?
Transport situation, that did improve a bit. Yeah, because there was plenty in England, like. And we had a lot of new vehicles. As time went on, so the improvement went on.
How did the civilian population of this area take to you?
You know, personally, I never had any a lot to do with the civilian population. We're always, if we went out for a pint, well, civilian population always seemed to sit one side the bar and soldiers the other side the bar. They never conversed a lot, as I can remember anyway. Even at Bridport, Lyme Regis, anywhere around there, all around the coast, where places I'd visited, there wasn't a lot of conversation. In any case, we were under instructions to say as little as possible. No, keep quiet about it. And what we were doing and where we were going, that was all hush up, hush hush.
So where were you accommodated?
We were in tents then by a village green. It was quite warm, so tents were all right. We'd had it rougher than that.
Were the officers in tents also?
No, some of them were, but some were in houses, private houses, you know.
Did this cause any resentment, men in tents and officers?
No, we know. Not as far as I was concerned. We knew that had happened anyway. The officers all get the best treatment. It doesn't matter what it is, food, billets, clothing, anything you like, they had first choice. We know that, that's the way things are.
How did you feed?
How did we?
Feed. What were the feeding arrangements?
Oh, well, there used to be a little 1500-weight truck come and bring us a group to the trenches on the beach. Oh, and you just went and got your mess tins out and filled the mess tins, and that was it.
Was the food good?
Yes, not bad. Yes, quite good cooked food at there. Mixed days. Some days you'd say it was rubbish, some days you'd say it was good. It all depended on your constitution, I think, or how many pints of beer you had the night before.
What was the situation regarding hygiene and latrines?
Ah, then we had open latrines. You know, dig a trench, knock some stakes in the ground with a lump of hessian, 6 foot hessian round, dig a trench, a pole just to sit on, and that was the toilets. I can tell you some stories about that, but I'm not going into that.
Were the men designated to do this work, digging latrines and so on?
Yes. Usually they got the, you know, if we were on exercise or anything, no, the pioneers would come and dig, the pioneer regiment would come and dig their latrines and fix it all up.
You said that there were trenches on the beaches. You dug these trenches.
Yes, yes.
What was the idea?
Because you were in them trenches day and night. 24 hours, you know, day in, day out. You slept in the trenches, no.
These were part of your duties?
Yes.
Were there any invasion scares at all, or stand twos?
There was one, yes, one. Who stand to, or, well, in any case, daybreak every morning we stood to. You know, and probably half an hour after daybreak, everything all right, we get, have to wait till we got the word, right, stand down, then you could relax a bit more. Well, you had that feeling whether anything going to happen or not. People's tone of voice tells you whether they're telling the truth or not. You know, he says, maybe stand down or just wave his hand.
And did this occur again at dusk?
Yes, dusk as well. An hour before dusk and an hour after. That was a vital time.
You said there was one big stand to for an invasion scare. Do you recall what that was?
No, because I believe that scare was right at the other end. Remember, we were, Abbotsbury is right on the south coast. I think it's near Dover Way or that the scare was, but once they alert one place, they alert the lot.
And you had to be turned out for it?
Yes, well, you stood by in any case. And you're always got to be prepared to move at a moment's notice. That was what we were told. A minute's notice, and that's all we need. Pack up, kit on the trucks, and away.
Was there any sign of enemy air activity going over you?
Oh yes, at that time the Battle of Britain was being fought, and it was good to see. Then that boosted our morale up again. You see, we thought, well, the Air Force whatever we'd said about them, we were wrong, because now they were doing their job. And there was no end of bombers coming over. In fact, one bomber landed at Dornier. We came down in the field next to us. And I gave Mark I took the plate off it. Make us a plate. And Mark's got that today. And the Air Force all came to guard that themselves. But at the very same day, there was a barrage balloon, and that was floating, it had broke free from its moorings. It was floating out to sea. Now, we all got hung onto it, and it burnt our hands, you know, the hose burnt our hands that hot, dragging us along. Until five of us took to hold it. And as luck happened, there's no trees around. As luck happened, we dug a trench and it went underneath a wall. And we had to run forward with the end of the hawser, you know, before the balloon could get drift of it, dive down this trench underneath the wall and tie it to the wall.